All right. So the goal here, I'm going to, you noticed I talk fast, sorry. But I'm going to try to get through this and leave enough time at the end for questions about how to put both of them together. So if you've got questions, be able to behold them and we'll try to get to some of them. So again, go back to the ladder that we started with. God's acts establish basic facts. We're going to be at now level two. God's commands fit those facts. And then tomorrow morning will be our applications ought to fit those commands and those facts. That's the three steps. So now we're going to try to talk about the second level and link them together. So here we are. God's commands fit these facts. Divine imperatives fit divine indicatives. These primal facts of creation, the perennial facts of nature, and the redemptive facts of the gospel. And so I use that word fit. It's a really important word for me. Fitness communicates we're not dealing with just like bare facts, but we're talking about facts as a fixed pattern of reality to which God's commands and our behavior can conform. So when you say something fits, so fitness is a bigger category. We don't have time to get into all of this tonight, but think about a proverb like as snow in summer and rain in harvest, so honor is not fitting for a fool. Okay, and so if you've ever seen something and you said that ain't right, okay, you get what fitness is. Okay, it means you have one thing and another thing, and they ought to fit. And so God's commands fit those facts. So what we do ought to fit what we are. Now, so this is the link between the indicative level and the imperative level. And because we're talking about God's commands, we're talking about moral fitness. So the connection between the divine indicatives, facts, and the divine imperatives, commands, is moral fitness. The commands morally fit the facts. So God's commands conform to the pattern that he has established in creation, in nature, and in redemption. So let's consider a couple of passages and see if you see it. Again, we're thinking framework, and the idea would be this framework will help you wherever you go in the Bible. So we're going to be here in 1 Timothy 2 for a minute. So if you want to turn there and follow along, we're in 1 Timothy 2, chapter 8, or 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 8, I should say, in one of those controversial passages, as they say. So we'll begin there in verse 8. I desire then that in every place the men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. I mentioned a moment ago that the different commands to men and women here are conditioned by their sexually inflected temptations. Men are tempted to be quarrelsome and violent. And then, likewise also, so notice it's likewise. So I desire that men should do this, and likewise I have another command that fits women, that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire. So those would be culturally determined expressions of immodesty, ostentatiousness. But instead, what should they clothe themselves with? But with what is proper for or fitting for women who profess godliness, namely with good works. Just incidentally here, some pastors rightly note in this passage that men like to fight and women like to dress in a way that gets men to fight. Okay, and that there's those sort of, just in the same way that our temptations often aggravate each other, here's another way that they do so. Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over man. Rather, she is to remain quiet. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet she will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. So notice, women must learn in quietness and submission. I don't have time to get into this, but the language of quietness in the Bible as the opposite of loud, I just read a great, there's a Twitter thread by Michael Foster the other day that nailed this. It's not mainly about your personality and whether you're an outgoing personality or a kind of quiet wallflower personality, but it has to do with whether or not you embrace and accept your place in the family of God and in the world. Right? And whether or not you diligently do the thing that God has required you to do, or you're always meddling in other people's business. Does that make sense? And so men can be loud, and women can be loud, and that's bad. And then men can be quiet, meaning they do the thing that God has called them to do, and women can be quiet and do the thing they do. So it's not mainly about your personality or anything like that. So But notice, women must learn. And so one of the things this reminds us of is that we ought not think that education of any kind is restricted to men or to women, right? I was talking to somebody earlier who'd gotten a theology degree from Union. I teach at a seminary where we have lots of women come, and we want them to get as high of education as they can in order to know and love God and do the thing that God has called them to do. So women must learn, but there's a particular manner in which they must learn. So there's value for here theological education for men and women. Should have mentioned a second ago. It's clear the context, the immediate context that Paul has in mind is the gathering worship service, right? So men are praying, and it's how women are dressing when they come to the assembly. And so that's the particular context we have in mind here. At the same time that they're to learn, they may not teach or exercise authority over men. And teaching and exercising authority here are two different things, but they're linked. Okay, so it's kind of like there's two different acts, but they're a package. And then Paul grounds that prohibition in Genesis 1 to 3. So that's what the word for is doing in verse 13. Here's the command, that's the imperative, grounded in some indicatives. So that's what we're getting at with our ladder. And he highlights two facts of creation. One we already talked about, the order of creation, Adam first, then Eve. And unlike Adam, this is the second, the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. So Adam's firstness and the fact of Eve's deception grounds Paul's insistence on restricting teaching and authority in the church to qualified men. So that's Adam's being created first, which is what we did last time. These are sort of six arguments for male headship in Genesis 1 to 3, together with Eve being directly targeted for temptation, as if the devil would discount Adam's presence and responsibility. That points to man's preeminent responsibility and leadership in the church, and that's the foundation on which the command is made that men alone be the authoritative teachers, we call them elders or pastors, in the church. Now, let me just say something, a little parenthesis about what I think is going on with the why does he insist Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived? Well, if you go back and you look in Genesis, and we can because we have Bibles in front of us, when God shows up, we talked about the fact that he confronts Adam first. Where are you? Where are you? I heard the sound of you. Who told you that you were naked? Did you eat of the tree? The woman you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit and I ate. And then the Lord said to the woman, what is this that you have done? And she says, the serpent deceived me and I ate. Now, it's significant that Adam said, the woman whom you gave me, she gave me the fruit. He doesn't say, the woman deceived me. But Eve says, the serpent deceived me. And so you're going, what's going on? So Eve was deceived, not Adam. And Eve was, how does he say it? The woman was deceived and became a transgressor through deception. And that matters for how we think about the church. I think what's going on here is this. It's not mainly about women being sort of more gullible than men. Okay, that's not the tenor. The more basic issue is that Adam could not be deceived in that situation. He couldn't. And the reason is because he heard the command from God himself. So God said, you may eat of every tree, except for that one. And the devil came and say, did God really say? And Adam can't be tricked. Does that make sense? There's no deception involved because he heard it from God himself. Adam knows what God has said. Now, Eve, on the other hand, had heard what God said through Adam. And so now, here she has her husband, one creature, saying, this is what God says. And now she has a serpent, I think is an angelic mediator of some kind, right? So it's the devil inhabiting a serpent. But it's an angelic mediator saying God said something else. So she's got to decide between two creatures about what God said, but she didn't hear what God said directly, which means it's possible for her to be deceived about which one speaks for God. And so when the serpent says, you won't die, and then she looks at the tree and says, you know, God's withholding something from you. He's trying to keep you down. He doesn't want you to have the knowledge of good and evil. Get into that if you want in the Q&A about what the knowledge of good and evil is. He doesn't want you to have it. And she looks at that tree and says, man, it's good for food. It's pleasant to the sight. Desirable to make one wise. And so she says, maybe God's trying to hold me down. She's being deceived by what he said. Okay? So she can be deceived, but Adam can't. Adam, on the other hand, So what this means is when Eve sins, hers is a sin of error and deception. That's how she becomes a transgressor. Adam's is more high-handed. So Adam, she eats the fruit, and now he's got a choice to make. Do I want her or God? It's just a straight up, I love my wife and I love God. And then God says, you chose her. Right? In fact, that's what when God confronts him. Because you listened to the voice of your wife, implied, instead of me. Right? Instead of me. That's the idea. You chose her over me. And in the process, blamed her for what you did. So, all of which is to say, God intended, he created Adam as the head, Eve from Adam's side as his helper, complementing him to rule over the beasts. That's the order that God establishes. The serpent comes back and says, goes to Eve first, tempts and deceives her, uses her and Adam's desire for her to make him fall and abandon God. Okay? But it's the upsetting and the overturning of God's created order that Paul has in mind here when he says Eve was deceived, not Adam. Okay. So while 1 Timothy 2 then prohibits women from two interrelated functions or activities, teaching, exercise, authority, these are closely tied to the office of elder in the local church. You can see that in 1 Timothy 3. These are the distinctive activities of pastor elders. So elders teach authoritatively from the scriptures, and elders lead or rule God's people by the scriptures. And those two activities are precisely what distinguishes elders from deacons in biblical polity. Deacons are not called to rule, so it's let elders who rule well are worthy of double honor, not deacons. Deacons have to be able to teach. Now, they may be able to teach. Some deacons are great teachers. We have some deacons at our church who are fantastic teachers, but they don't have to be. Okay? It's when you look at the list of qualifications for elders and deacons, the one that's different is elders must be able to teach. Deacons may be able to teach. Does that make sense? So these are the activities tied to eldership. Later, in other books of the Bible, Peter and Paul's references to the task of shepherding as a reference to what elders do. So Acts 20:28, 1 Peter 5, 1-4, shepherd the flock of God that's among you. So what do shepherds do? Shepherds feed the flock from the word, they lead the flock by the word, and they guard the flock from wolves and thieves. That's what shepherds do. And so there's a fitness here, this is what I mean by fitness, between the way that God has built men to be protectors, nourishers, and leaders, and the restriction of the office of elder to men. Like it fits. It's not just arbitrary. It's not flip a coin. It fits the way God made it. So in leading God's people, in teaching sound doctrine, in guarding the worship of the church, pastor elders follow in the footsteps of the Levite. So here's one of the things, this may be, take a little tangent here, but I think it's important. So you remember the Levites in the Old Testament. Levites were charged with guarding the worship of God by prioritizing the glory and holiness of God. So do you remember when the Levites were called to their ministry? You remember the story? It's in Exodus chapter 32 at the golden calf. Okay, so you remember Moses up on the mountain. People are like, we don't know what happened to Moses. Aaron, where's he at? And, you know, make us gods who will go before us. We feel afraid and scared, and we don't know what happened to Moses. We don't know what happened to him. And Aaron, like Adam, quite frankly, this is actually history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Aaron, like Adam, he's the head. He's in charge while Moses is gone. He says, I'll do whatever you want. Bring me your gold. And they puts it into the fire. They mold it into a golden calf, and the people start to worship. Now, remember when Moses comes down the mountain, you know, God says, hey, the people, they're breaking out. They're doing all this stuff again. And Moses goes down and is like, what in the world? Like 10 minutes ago, we gave you the law and said, don't worship idols. And you hear you guys are going, these are your gods who brought you out of Egypt. Aaron, what are you doing? And Aaron says, the people you gave me. Right? The people you gave me. He says, I put the stuff in, calf popped out. I was just standing here. I was surprised as anybody. Didn't know fire could do that. Okay? That's Aaron being Adam. Does that make sense? In fact, just maybe wrap it back into because we'll come back to faithful headship later, but unfaithful headship. Adam walks through this progression of passivity, So here's the devil talking to his wife saying, did God say this? And I think it was fine for a minute to see, this is me speculating a little bit, but when the serpent says, did God really say to Eve, Adam could sit back for a second and say, let's see if she, I taught her. I gave her the word of God. Can she repeat back the word of God? And she repeats it back, and she gets it slightly wrong because she mentions touching it, and there's a whole question mark about whether this is a wise, like, extra layer of protection or like a legalism, because God didn't say anything about touching it. But leave that aside. She repeats it back. The serpent's question was actually, did God really say you may not eat from any tree? Does that make sense? So God said you may eat from every tree except one, and the serpent came and said, you can't eat from any of these trees? And she said, well, we may eat from every tree, but except for that one, we may not touch it lest we die. When the devil then says, you will not surely die, Adam ought to pick up a sword. Okay? But instead, he stands there, and we find this out later when it says the woman took some of the fruit and gave it to her husband who was with her the entire time. So he's passive. Lets the devil have it, his wife, lets his wife do what she wants. And then, there's passivity. Then there's idolatry. When it comes time, she falls, and now he's got a choice. Do I eat what she just ate, or do I obey God? I choose her. I choose creature, not creator. That's idolatry. And then, when it comes time to pay the piper, when God shows up and says, it's judgment day, he says, kill her, not me. It's abuse, right? So passivity, idolatry, abuse is that pattern, okay? Fast forward now back to the Aaron story. We don't know where Moses is. We're so upset. We need some gods. Well, I don't know. I'll just do whatever you say. Passivity. What do? Then they build an idol and worship. These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. Idolatry. Moses shows up as the representative of God. The people did it. I was just standing here. It's the same pattern. Does that make sense? You see it again, just by the way, if you want to fast forward again to Samuel and Saul, when God says, wipe out the Amalekites. Don't let anything alive. And then he kind of goes along with it. And then Samuel comes up and he says, hey, what's the sound of bleating of sheep and why is that guy still alive? Why is the king still alive? He's like, well, I thought that God would really want me to do. No, God told you what he wanted you to do. And you decided I don't want to do that. And presumption is as idolatry. There's the word. So it's passivity, it's idolatry. And he says, well, you know the people, how they always do what they want. I was just doing what the people said. Blames the people again. Head blames the body. This is a pattern. This is Adamic humanity. Passivity, idolatry, abuse. Back off the tangent to the Levites. Moses comes down and says, what are you doing? Aaron passes the buck, and then Moses asks a question. He says, who's on the Lord's side? To me. Whoever's on the Lord's side, come to me. And so the Levites come running up, and the Levites are like, here we are, we're on the Lord's side. And he says, grab your swords and go to and fro among your brethren and slay the idolaters. Okay? And that language, actually, of this to and fro should sound familiar. Do you remember when you've heard of a sword going to and fro? If you know your early chapters of Genesis, you know that after Adam and Eve were kicked out, God established a cherubim at the garden and gave him a flaming sword that went to and fro to guard the way to the tree of life. So the Levites, the people were supposed to be a people of priests, and now the Levites are saying, we're going to take up that task. Now, here's the thing about that. That means that the priestly task includes the possibility of violence. Right? Like what made the Levites really good priests is that they cared more for the holiness of God than they did for their own brothers. Does that make sense? Like who's on the Lord's side versus the idolatrous people who are your neighbors and your friends and your family. And we care more about that. Oh, we're going to do it with the Lord's side. And the Levites obey God violently and God stays the plague that was wrecking the people in the absence. Let me give you one more example on this. I'm just trying to get you what a priest is. You have to just get, like, sometimes there was a season in Christian ministry, 15, 20 years ago, where people would talk about priestly leadership. And what priestly leadership was, for some people, was like the gentle pastor. Okay? Like they would talk about, like, some pastors are more prophets and they thunder, and some pastors are more priests, and they're like, how's your soul, brother? And it's like, that's fine. You should have pastors who are like, how's your soul, brother? I'm not saying that's bad. What I'm saying is don't connect that to priesthood. The priests are the guys with the swords who stand at the doorway of God's house, and if someone tries to get in that shouldn't be there, they pull out the sword and they kill them. That was the priest's job. That's what the Levites did in guarding the tabernacle. So again, fast forward one more time into Numbers. You remember when the Israelite went and took the Midianite wife, and they came down and had their little pride parade into the camp, marching down, strutting. Here we are with my Midianite bride, contrary to God's law. Moses and Aaron and the people and the elders of Israel over at the tent of meeting, and they're weeping, lamenting this great evil, which is an appropriate response when somebody is committing high-handed rebellion. Meanwhile, Phinehas, one of Aaron's sons, says, weeping's good, but insufficient. And he goes and he grabs a big spear, and he goes and pins the idolater and his bride to the ground, and God says, that guy will make a great priest. I will give you a priest forever. You're a priest forever, Phinehas. Way to go. And so Phinehas becomes sort of a paradigm priest. So notice the common connection between the Levites taking up swords in defense of God's honor and holiness and Phinehas taking up holiness. Now, come all the way back to the New Testament and say, what are pastors for? Okay, pastors do lots of things that all Christians should do. Like pastors should be the lead one another's. All of our one another, love one another, care for one another, serve one another. Pastors should lead the way as exemplary Christians of that. But the distinctive thing about the pastoral office is that guardianship. Is that I have a sword. And if someone tries to do something contrary to what the book says, I use the sword and I say no. And I don't care if you're my friend. Overstatement. I do care that you're my friend, and I might cry about it. But I'm not going to let my tears prevent me from doing what must be done. Does that make sense? Now, this is why it's that combination of God having built men to be protectors, to be guardians, to work and to keep and to guard, and that office which entails guarding the sanctuary of God, guarding the doctrine and worship of the church. That's why Paul says, I don't permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. Because that office, those activities are so important that I've built someone to do it. And it's not you, ladies. I've built you for other more glorious things. He's going to guard outside and you're going to make it life inside. Okay, we'll get to that in a minute. So all of what you say, come back around. Levites were authorized to use force to guard the sanctuary. One of their fundamental tasks was to teach the word of God and exercise authority in sacred matters. Nehemiah 8, they read from the book, from the law of God. Clearly, they gave the sense so that the people understood the reading. That's what pastors do too. Pastor elders are not authorized to use physical force in protecting Christ's people, although some of you guys here in Middle Tennessee are like, I'm packing, I'm good, in case I need it. The analogy between the Levites and the elder pastors sheds light on the protective and directive role elders play in the church. Okay, the commands fit the indicatives, the facts. Okay, second one. Now let's jump to Ephesians and let's consider marriage. Consider the moral fitness in Ephesians 5 of Paul's commands and exhortations to husbands and wives. Okay, in Colossians 3, Paul says, wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. So there's that language of fitness that I'm talking about. Husbands, love your wives, don't be harsh with them. So there's a harmony and fitness between a wife's submission and who she is as a woman in Christ and a husband's love and his headship. That's unpacked for us in Ephesians 5. So let's listen to this whole passage in Ephesians 5, 22. You're all familiar with it. I just want to give you a framework for understanding it. Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. The husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives, as Christ loved the church, gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives, notice here's another comparison, as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, hold fast to his wife, the two will become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I'm saying it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. So throughout that passage, notice, we have both facts and commands. indicatives and imperatives. The husband is the head of his wife. The wife is the body of her husband. Together they are one flesh. Christ is the head of the church, his body, which is the redemptive pattern to which we conform. These are all facts. Then wives are called to submit to their husbands, and husbands are called to love their wives. These are commands, and the commands fit the facts. The imperatives fit the indicatives. Let me underline something really important here. Paul regards a husband's headship as a fact, as an indicative, not an imperative. Just think about it, the implications of that. We ought not exhort husbands, be the head. That's a command, right? Be the head, that's a command. Don't say that. You should not tell husbands, you should be the head of your home. Do not say that. You follow me here? You should not say, I never say to husbands, you should be the head. I do wedding homilies. Everyone I do, I say to them, look, brother, I'm not going to tell you that you should be the head. I'm going to tell you are the head, whether you want to be or not. The only question is, headship's the given. The only question is, will you be an unfaithful head like Adam and Aaron and Saul, or a faithful head like Jesus? But headship is a given. It may be a domineering headship. It may be an absentee headship. It may be a passive headship. It may be a strong, sacrificial headship. But one way or the other, the husband is indicative of the head. Does that make sense? That's really important to get. And in fact, one of the things you find is for people who don't like the teaching, biblical teaching on this, that's way more offensive than if you were to say, husbands, be the head. Because then it sounds like it's something you have to rise to. It's a command that you can obey or not. And I'm saying, you can't disobey this. You can do it badly. I'll come back to that in a minute. The other thing to underline here is I used to summarize when I was teaching on manhood and womanhood, say a decade ago, teaching on this, and I would summarize the biblical teaching of complementarity on marriage as under this banner of headship and submission. The biblical teaching on headship and submission. Now you think, given what you have so far, can you see what's wrong with that? The category confusion that you make when you do that? If you summarize it, headship and submission. Anyone want to take a stab at it? What's the problem? Bingo. You're confusing indicatives and imperatives. Okay? Instead, we do well to distinguish indicatives and imperatives and then link them appropriately. The husband is the head. The wife is the body. So you could speak of headship and bodyship. That would be a good way to summarize it. Or I'm going to draw in the language of 1 Corinthians 11, which I'll get to in a minute. He is the head, she's the glory. So headship and gloryhood, to coin a term. That'd be another way to talk about marriage. Headship and gloryhood are basic facts revealed in the Bible, and from those flow the appropriate imperatives. Love like Jesus, submit like the church. Cherish like Jesus, honor and respect like the church. The imperatives fit the indicatives. All right, one more passage, maybe a couple more passages actually. So 1 Corinthians is one I'm not going to spend quite as much time on because it's complicated. 1 Corinthians 11, if you want to flip there, and we can all be confused together. Okay, this is a really odd passage. Everybody stumbles over certain things. What all exactly is going on? There's places where I go, I think this is where I lean about what's happening, but some of it's not particularly clear. However, there are certain things that are crystal clear. And this is what you do when you encounter a passage that's hard and there's things that are unclear. Start with the things you know and then work towards the things you don't know. But don't let the things you don't know mute the things you do know. Okay? That's silly. So what do we know? I want you to understand, verse 3, that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife, or there's a question mark here. This is one of the interpretive decisions you have to make. The head of a woman is the man. Or is it the head of a wife is her husband? That's unclear. And the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. I think that dishonors Jesus. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, her husband, or the man. It's the same as if her head were shaven. For if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it's disgraceful for a wife, that's like unfitting, for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, and then we get the reason, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. That's what I mentioned a second ago. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That's why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man from woman. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman. And all things are from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife, notice proper, fitting, for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it's a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it's her glory. For her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. So there's some stuff in there, like what the angels are doing in there, how the head, the coverings, what did it mean? How did it symbolize authority? All that in the first century. So there's a bunch of cultural stuff here that I've got questions about. But there's a bunch of biblical stuff here that I don't. So what do we see? The first thing is, there's this fundamental order of reality. Sacred order or hierarchy. Christ is not the head of God. God is the head of Christ. Man is not the head of Christ. Christ is the head of man. Wife is not the head of her husband. Man is not the head of woman, or woman is not the head of man. That's one. There's a sacred order or hierarchy. Two, Paul, you heard it, right? Calls back to Genesis 1 and 2. Man is the image and glory of God. Woman is the glory of man. Now, that underscores a couple things. Notice that he doesn't say woman is the image of man. She's not. She's the image of God too, like he is. But she is the glory of man. And Paul explains the last phrase, glory of man, by highlighting two primal facts of creation that we talked about in the first hour. Woman was made out of man, and woman was made for man. She was built from his side and built to be his helper. And those two facts mean that for Paul, he is her head, she is his glory. And this is really important because I think sometimes people go, well, if she's just the glory of man, that makes her lesser or deficient. But that's not true. She too is made in God's image, and as the glory of the man, she's the glory of the glory, right? She's the brightness of the glory. And the fact that woman is man's glory doesn't diminish her any more than the fact that man is the glory of God diminishes him, right? It's not like, oh, that's all? Okay, if you think that way about glory, you don't understand what the word glory means in the Bible. Nevertheless, because Eve was built from Adam's side and as his helper, woman is man's glory, and she should reflect this fundamental fact of nature, of creation, in how she worships in public. That's what 1 Corinthians 11 is about. Third thing we see in the passage that's clear, man's headship and woman's gloryhood entail a mutual dependence upon each other. It's not good for man to be alone. It's not good for woman to be alone. Our differences are not differences from each other so much as differences for each other. They complement. There's a profound interdependence. And then Paul demonstrates this by using a primal fact, man as woman was made from man, with a perennial fact of nature, fact of nature. Man is now born of woman. The original woman was built from the man's side, the first man, and since then, every man you've ever met has come into the world through a woman. And those are loaded for Paul with symbolic significance that highlights our mutual need for each other. So we have these facts of nature in 1 Corinthians that lead to fitting ways for us to worship. One, there's a sacred order in reality from God to Christ to man to woman. Two, man is head, woman is glory. She was made from him and for him. As head and glory, there's a mutual dependence between men and women, witnessed in Scripture's account of our origins and testified to in every birth. And fourth, these facts of creation and nature guide us as we seek to offer acceptable worship to God. That's what's clear, whatever other questions we may have. And I highlight that issue of fitness in all of this because this is really where the rubber meets the road for a lot of folks. There are a lot of folks, complementarians today, who say things like, we don't know why God says that husbands are the head of their home and wives should submit and only men are able to be pastors. We don't know, but the Bible says it. So we'll do it, okay? Now, let me analyze that for you for a sec. Obedience is better than disobedience, okay? But Obeying because God says so, without understanding the reasons beneath the rules, is an immature obedience. Right? And think about it with your kids. When they're three, why? Because I said so is sufficient. But at 12 or 15, why should be met with obedience first and then maybe an answer. Right? Like I tell my kids all the time, when my son, why can't I do this? Why can't I do that? Why can't I be on my device at this time? Why? I want to say, how's this? Obey first, and then I'll answer your question. I want you to understand the reasons beneath the rules. And here's the deal. Immature obedience can begin to regard God's commands as arbitrary, perhaps even irrational, and thus that kind of immature obedience is difficult to sustain over time. It's especially difficult to hand off immature obedience. If you're immaturely obeying, your kids will disobey. Does that make sense? Like, that's what will happen. And so, what we want is mature obedience. So, obedience is better than disobedience. Mature obedience is better than immature obedience. Mature obedience is better than immature obedience. What is immature obedience? It recognizes that God's commands are not arbitrary, they're fitting. There are reasons beneath the rules, and you should know and love the reasons beneath the rules so that you can joyfully and gladly and perseveringly obey the Lord Jesus. In fact, here's the fundamental thing. The first fundamental biblical imperative when it comes to this subject is just to embrace and love the indicatives. Follow that? Like, it's not mainly like, here's a bunch of list of things that you should do as a man and you should do them. The first thing is, just love that God did it this way. Because if you try to do all of the other things that we could talk about in terms of marriage or in terms of how you engage with people in the church or whatever, you try to do all of those and you hate that God did it this way, you won't do those for very long. And they won't honor God. The first thing is, just love that God made men different from women and women different from men. If you love that, and you love the glory of that, then all of the other stuff kind of falls out more naturally, or perhaps with the Spirit's help, supernaturally. So you can't love your wife as Christ loved the church unless you first love that she's a woman and not a man. And you can't honor your husband as the church honors Christ unless you first love that he is a man and not a woman. I have a little thing here you can ask about. I'm going to skip it because I want to wrap up and give time for questions. One of the foundation of that idea of first this is when we look in Romans 1, that famous idolatry passage, the thing that after they commit idolatry and ingratitude, they don't honor God as God or give thanks, and God gives them over to a depraved mind, to the lust of their hearts. It says, he gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. The men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, committing shameless acts with men and receiving the due penalty for their error. That whole bit has to do with whether or not you view the other sex as something beautiful and valuable. Right? That's what's underneath that. And so one of the things that I'd love to do on a passage like this is to invert it. Like, you want to understand what it's saying, just flip it around. And say, like, what would the opposite of this be? So if the wrath of God is revealed against all that nastiness, what's the pleasure of God revealed for? What? So that makes God angry. What makes God happy? And you can just flip stuff around. So here's how I did that. I said I wasn't going to do it, and then here I am. So I'm skipping through bunch of the stuff about how we honor God as God, and we give thanks to him, and we've become fool for Christ, and we're wise, and we receive his glory, and all that stuff. We get to this part. For this reason, God renews their desires and delights and passions. In other words, he doesn't give them over to dishonorable ones. For the women glory in the masculinity of their husbands, and the men likewise revel in the femininity of their wives. Okay? Like, that is the opposite of what Romans 1 says. Like, so the renewed life is going to look like men glorying in that women are not like us and loving that. All of the ways that women, instead of trying to impose, say, women, you should be more like us. No. And women, you should be more like us. No. Like, glory in the difference, in the complementarity. Last thing, and then we'll take some questions here. Defining headship and bodyship, okay? I want to circle back to that question and grasp it a little bit better. These are indicatives. So I'm just trying to get your imagination going here about what is meant by headship. So we're talking about one flesh. So we'll stick to marriage, although I think if you work your way out, the same sorts of stuff will apply in the head of a company or the head of a state or the head of a church or heads of church, if you got, you know, we got plural elders. So you got one, but we'll start with marriage. One flesh, one whole body, and within that one flesh, there's a head and a body. And so you can break it down into part, and they need each other, because you don't want a bodiless head or a headless body. Not cool. So what is the head doing by nature in that body? Number one, I have two things, and this is how I would define headship. The head orders, not barks orders, but like structures, directs the whole body for its purpose. How? Through presence, words, and actions. The head orders and structures the body for its purpose through its presence, words, and actions, and empowers the members of the body to fulfill their calling. So there's two things, structuring and empowering. That's what the head does internally. Second, what does the head do externally? The head maintains the body's boundaries. This is my body, and that is your body. That's that kind of a guardianship. Represents the body to other bodies. Think about how Adam is the representative of the human race. The king represents the people, that sort of thing. And is responsible for the well-being of the body as a whole. So if the body goes wrong, God shows up and says, "Where are you, singular head?" Follow that? That's what the head does. So the whole body has a purpose, right? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, etc. The head is the member that orients the body for that purpose, guides and directs the body for that purpose. And you will do this intentionally or unintentionally, well or badly. But you'll do it. The head will do it. And I stress the notion of presence in this definition because I think that that's a really good image to think about. Or I use, when I try to give people imaginative hooks for this, the head orients and orders and structures and directs the body the way that the earth orients and structures the moon, like by gravity. So like a planet with its moon, a husband guides his home through his gravity. And if he does so faithfully, the moon's going to orbit properly. And if he does so unfaithfully, that moon is going to wander into disorder and maybe crash into some stuff. Another way to think of it. The head will set the tone. He'll lay down the beat. He will establish the rhythm. And it could be a steady beat that allows for some beautiful music. Or it may be, and it may be a melody line that enables some awesome harmony, or it may be offbeat, out of tune, and you end up with just noise. But one way or the other, the head is going to establish that rhythm and melody. Final image, one more here. The head works in the whole body like the way the immune system works in your body. An immune system doesn't merely fight off infection. Well, that's one thing it does. Guards the boundaries, maintains the boundaries. The immune system regulates the body's function, maintains the body's boundaries, defends the body from attack by recognizing and deploying appropriate measures. Hey, stop lying to my wife. Here's a sword. So, this means that a faithful head is present even when he's absent. Okay. When dad is at work and mom's disciplining the kids, a faithful head casts a long shadow. Like when mom is dealing with sons who are getting a little mouthy, they ought to see dad's shadow all the way from the office, right? Looming behind. What is he doing? He's regulating and ordering the home by his gravity. Meanwhile, an unfaithful head will be weightless even when he's present. He's checked out, on the phone, not present, not orienting, but he's still setting a tone. And it's a tone that brings misery to his whole household. The passivity, I'm just going to sit back, I'm not going to engage, all of that, he's still setting tone in his home. So his passivity, lack of initiative, leaves a gap that drowns out all the other music. So now back to bodyship. So if headship is ordering and empowering internally, and then representing, guarding boundaries, representing, and responsibility for the whole, what's the counterpart in bodyship? Here's how I've summarized it thus far. The body, in this case is the wife, receives the initiating presence, words, and actions of the head, because that's what he does, and then makes them fruitful by providing feedback, input and counsel to the head. Feedback, input, and counsel to the head. So that's what it does internally. And then the body glorifies, or here's a fun word, fructify, make fruitful, fructify the head's efforts by keeping in step with the head. He's laying down the beat, she's right there with him. Carrying out the head's direction and extending and amplifying the whole body's influence in the world. That's what the body does. So here's the fundamental, truth about the body side of this, which in our analogy is husband and wife here, talking about the wife. The body receives in order to give more. The body receives in order to give more. This is indicative. This is what women will do. This is why if you have a lousy husband, she's receiving lousiness, and what does she give back? More lousiness. Okay? That's how it works. It amplifies. Lawlessness leads to more lawlessness. On the other hand, he's faithful and she's faithful, she's going to multiply beauty and goodness. So she doesn't just receive and return, it's receive and glorify. It's receive and beautify. It's receive and amplify. And the most obvious way this shows up, if you just want like a real basic biological way, is procreation. Like, this is the biblical imagery. We just forget that this is actually the connection between what the image is doing. The husband plants his seed in the garden of his wife, and she brings forth fruit. So she takes something small, and she makes it glorious. She's the sort of people that people come out of. He is the breadwinner. She's the bread maker. He's the sun. She's the moon. Now think about that analogy. Some people might think that's demeaning, but do you know what the moon does? It brings light where there's no light. Like, that's what the moon is. It's not the moon isn't the source of the light in the way God made the world. Instead, the moon brings light in the darkest place on earth where there's no sun, but she extends the sun's influence where the sun is not. And I think there's biblical roots for that comparison. Song of Songs does it. Book of Genesis does it. He forms, she fills. He sets the melody, she brings the harmony and makes the simple song into a symphony. He empowers her, she receives the power and enlarges the domain of her household. She provides influence and input to the head, for good or for ill. You can think about this. Adam listened to the voice of his wife. Bad call. Nabal, you remember this story from the book of Samuel, did not listen to the voice of his wife Abigail, and he fell into grave evil and destruction. So one way or another, there's influence, and it's whether or not it's for good or for ill. Book of Proverbs is a good way to think about this as well. So in the book of Proverbs, what you have is you have a father giving counsel to his son, who's the prince. So it's a king to a prince. And the father wants his son to go on two quests. He needs to seek wisdom so that he can be a wise king, and he needs to seek a wife, an excellent one. And throughout the book, there's this choice before him. Are you going to listen to Lady Wisdom, or are you going to listen to Lady Folly? Are you going to choose the excellent wife, or are you going to choose the adulterous woman? And over again, that's the, and it's like, and in both cases, the women are calling. But Wisdom's like, hey, come over here, seek me, find me. If you find me, I'll bring you life, I'll bring you joy, I'll bring you honor, I'll bring you riches, I will multiply all of your efforts, come with me. Meanwhile, adulterous woman's like, hey, come down here. No, get a little closer, get a little closer, and then open the door and push you down the steps to hell. Okay? But in both cases, who he listens to will matter. And that's why you get 9 chapters of setting forth the basic principle. From chapter 10 through chapter 30, it's here's a bunch of wisdom proverbs, hearkening to the voice of Lady Wisdom for those chapters. And then at the very end, he's given the picture of his bride from his mom, right? It's an oracle that his mom told him, the excellent wife of Proverbs 31. And you can read on it. And you can see how what she's doing is very much like this, right? So she takes initiative in seeking wool and flax. She labors diligently to provide for the needs of her household. She operates beyond the boundaries of the household as she brings food from afar. She extends the boundaries of the household by purchasing land and planting vineyards. She makes goods, perceives their value, is active in selling them. She's generous to the poor. She cares for her family. She beautifies her home. She speaks with wisdom. She teaches with kindness. And most importantly, the heart of her husband trusts in her. And she does him good all the days of his life. Okay, so this is, and this, that's what Abigail is trying to do for Nabal, and his name is the fool. That's what his name means in Hebrew, is fool, and his parents knew. All right, so thus we move from indicatives to imperatives, from basic headship to faithful headship. Here's my definition. Glad-hearted, sacrificial stability and competence for the sake of the household and God's mission. Glad-hearted, sacrificial stability and competence for the sake of God's, for his household and God's mission. And then we move from bodyship to faithful bodyship. Glad-hearted submission, wise assistance and counsel for the sake of the household and God's mission. Now we'll take some questions. What is the knowledge of good and evil? The knowledge of good and evil, I think, is a Hebrew way of talking about wisdom. So if you do a little search on that phrase throughout the Bible, knowledge of good and evil, God has it. I think the angels have it when he says man has become like us. I think that's a reference to the angelic council, that angels have the knowledge of good and evil. Later in the book, like in Deuteronomy, it's before the kid knows how to choose the good and reject the evil. So little kids don't have it. Old men lack it. Later in the book, I think it's the book of Samuel or Kings, there's an old man who's no longer knows good and evil. When Solomon asked God for, we say, what did Solomon ask for? When God said, I'll give you anything you want. What did Solomon ask for? Yeah, and he says, give me an understanding mind that I might discern between good and evil. Okay, in the book of Hebrews, it says, by now you ought to be teachers, but you need someone to instruct you in the basic oracles. But solid food is for the mature, for those who have their powers of discernment trained by constant practice to distinguish good from evil. So good and evil, knowledge of good and evil, discernment between good and evil runs throughout the Bible as shorthand, it's actually longhand, for wisdom. Okay? Which is why when Eve looks at the tree and she says, this tree is desirable to make one wise, she's seeing the truth. That's what it's for. Which then means, so follow from that, why would God not want them to eat from the wisdom tree? Super weird, right? Well, actually not. What's the beginning of wisdom? Yeah, so it's obey me first, trust me. It's a good thing, and I will give it to you. At the right time, you will receive the knowledge of good and evil, but you need to receive it as a gift from your father, not as a gift from the devil. Okay? Don't seize mature wisdom. So it's mature kingly wisdom is what the knowledge of good and evil is, I think. And so the no, it's one no in a world of yes. You mate from every tree except for that one, and it's a temporary no. First, they need to trust God, and then when at the right time, God will give them the knowledge of good and evil, and I think he'll clothe them. So I think God intends, they're created immature, spiritually speaking, and that's signaled by their lack of clothing and their lack of wisdom. And they need to grow up into that by first obeying God. They obey God and they trust him. I don't understand why. I'm going to trust my father because he's good. And then God would give them the blessing. And if you say, yeah, I still don't know, let me just give you a couple other little examples of the pattern throughout Scripture. Jesus is the best one. The devil takes Jesus up onto the peak and looks out. Here's all the glory of the kings, the glories of the kings of the earth. And it's like, is it wrong for Jesus to want those? And the answer is no. He intends to get them. He's just not going to get them as a gift from the devil. He has a different way to get them called obeying his father and accomplishing the task that his father set him. And once he does that, he will get the kingdoms of the earth as his inheritance. So it's a good thing that he must not take a shortcut for. I think this is part of what's going on in Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges. In Deuteronomy, the people are told, when you come into the land and possess it, ask for a king like the nations that are around you, and here's the requirements of what you should have. You know, he doesn't need to have much gold, doesn't have not many wives. He needs to copy down a book of the law with his own hand and get the Levites to check him in case he leaves out that one verse, because he might do that. So you got to get, he's a copy of the book of the law, checked by the Levites, because they're the guardians, and then not a lot of gold, not a lot of wives. Okay, but you can ask for a king, and God says, that's cool. Then they get into then you're in the book of Samuel, and the people are like, give us a king like the nations. And Samuel's like, how dare you reject God? And you're like, what in the heck? What's going on here? Well, what didn't they do? What didn't they do between Deuteronomy and 1 Samuel? Answer, they did not obey God as their king and cast out the peoples of the land. They did not possess the land in the way he commanded them to. They were unfaithful, but they still wanted, it's like if you told your kids, Hey, if you were a trustworthy and faithful 12, 13, 14, and 15-year-old, when you turn 16, I'll get you a car and you can have a license and go drive. And then all of a sudden your kid's like 14 and he's been a punk for the last 2 years and he's like, give me the car now. And it's like, you said I could have a car. And it's like, no. What I said was, if you are a faithful 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old, then when you're 16, you can have a car. I didn't say, you can have a car. Does that make sense? And so this is what Israel's doing in demanding a king before they'd obeyed. They didn't fear the Lord, but they still wanted the wisdom. And so this is what I think is going on in that chapter, which I think has all kinds of implications for parenting, by the way. I just walked this through with my 12-year-old, because he's like, but how come I can't just be on the internet by myself all the time? You're on the internet by yourself. Is it wrong to be on the internet by yourself? How come I have to ask your permission before I use the device? Because I want you to trust me. I want to know I can trust you. Yeah, but why? And I'm like, okay, let's go to Genesis. I have a Bible study for you. And around an hour, walked through that whole, what I just did, and said, you see how God, like that command, like it was a good thing that he wanted. It was a good thing that God intended to give them, but not right now. You gotta wait, you gotta be patient, don't seize. Yep, question?
Yes. My parents weren't Christians.
Okay.
But they lived the headship. I think they really believed that was a good way to live their marriage. Would you say that today there is no way that a non-Christian can even live that way in our culture that we're living in and what they're being taught? And it's impossible to put that on anyone but a Christian, really.
I wouldn't say it's impossible. I would say it's far less likely because they've got a catechism for how this should go, and their catechism is a bunch of lies. But here's the funny thing about that. Nature is stubborn. So one of the things that's really interesting is that, like, despite all of their efforts to, like, make an egalitarian paradise where there's no ordering, there's no asymmetries, there's no, everything's equal, they can't get away from them because this is the world God made, which is why they're like, we hate the patriarchy, but now women can apparently do everything better than men, including being women, right? All of the awards are going to the men who are pretending to be women. And so it's like, wow, men are even better at being women than women are. Who knew? And so it's like, it's how ludicrous that is, that they can't get away from the patriarchy. They just live it out in a really ugly, distorted, absurd way. Another example is, you guys can go track this down on your own if you want. There's this advertisement from a couple of years ago. It was a Heineken ad from England, which is great because you asked the question. It was a British Heineken ad. It was like a 4-minute long ad. And the whole thing was like, how do we get together and talk to one another across our divide? And so they had these people do interviews, and then they would pair them up, and they would have to like build something together. They didn't know each other at all. Build something together, and it ended up being like a little bar top, like something like this size bar top. And then they get to share a Heineken together. And while they're sharing the Heineken, TV comes on, and it's their little interview where they discover that they're like opposite sides of all of the big issues. Does that make sense? So it's like, see, you worked together on this thing and you had a Heineken. Wasn't that great? Don't fight. That was the kind of basic message. Can't we all get along? Well, one of so they had a guy who was like a radical environmentalist guy who thought we're all just polluting planet, and another guy who thinks that's a bunch of bunk. So they build the thing, and then they discover, you're like a greenie, and like, you think we should just guzzle all the gas and burn up the ozone, and then it's like, and then so they're like, let's talk, and so what they did was funny, let's debate that right now, right, because it's two dudes, and they're going to fight about what they disagree about, but then like, oh man, that was great, and they hug each other at the end. That was one. Second was a guy and a gal, they build the thing, they find out, she's like a down with the patriarchy gal, and he's like a manosphere, like, men. Oh, shoot, what are we going to do? Well, what's interesting is they started joking, and he started being like, yeah, smash the patriarchy. So what did he do? He didn't hit a girl. The guys, like, didn't back, the first two guys, when it was two guys, didn't back down from their environmental opinions. But he kind of muted his opinions and kind of, like, tried to accommodate her. So what was that? It was nature coming through even there in that deal. Third one was most fascinating. It's a guy and a gal building, old guy, young gal. Then they show the video. Turns out he's a guy who's like, he's like, I don't know what the whole deal is with all this transgender stuff. It's so stupid. Blah, 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 blah. Goes off on that. Turns out gal is not a gal. Gal is a very convincing man presenting as a woman, you know, who was in the army at one point, but is so like they were both, they'd both been in the army, but like now he's presenting as a very convincing woman, okay? And so now old guy's like, oh. And so now you're like, what's going to happen? Well, what's interesting is he treated, so now you go, how is he going to treat him? Is it going to be like exhibit A, two dudes fighting over environmentalism? Or is it like exhibit B, where Manosphere guy is smash the patriarchy, cheers to feminist? What do you think? It was the second. Because the way she presented, I keep doing it because it was very convincing. The way he presented was feminine. And so old man taught his whole life, don't hit girls, don't hit girls. And this guy is presenting as a girl, so I'm not going to hit. And at the end, he's like, and so it's like he moves that way. Now, what's funny is they kind of present this as like, hey, can't we all get along? And at one level, it's like they're trying to conform you to gender ideology, modern nonsense. But they can't get away from the fact that you treat men and women differently. So nature is a stubborn son of a gun and will always reassert itself. Yep.
So when you were talking about the headship,
yeah,
and being submissive, mm-hmm. like headship is indicative, submissive yeah. is imperative.
Correct.
So we should say headship and the glory of man.
Yep.
Or
yes, headship and gloryhood, headship and bodyship, something okay. like that. Yep.
So submission. I have always been taught
yeah.
to obey my husband and. Yeah. This is the first time I hear somebody saying, like, we are a team or something.
Uh-huh.
Like, I have to do what my husband says, even if he makes a mistake.
Uh-huh.
So how do I...
You're saying that's a new thing that you need to sort of submit to your husband to you?
No. It's like we've been always taught
yeah.
that we need to be submissive.
Okay.
It's not like we are a team, I give advice, we are together in this.
Yes.
It's like he is the one who ultimately will take the decision, and I have to... Yeah. Submit to that.
Yes.
So how I can reconcile?
I'm not sure I'm following. Like where the tension is.
The tension is that will I leave my husband to take a bad decision?
Oh, because he's the headship. Gotcha. So it depends.
Like
it depends. Okay, so if your husband is doing Adam stuff or Aaron stuff, right? Yeah. So if your husband is leading you into manifest sin, then no, because you obey him. Your submission to him is under God. So obey God first, even if your husband is disobeying God. Okay? But part of obeying God means if he's just making a decision about wisdom calls and he's just making foolish calls, okay? So you think that's not a good idea. You have a responsibility as a wife to give him counsel and wisdom and to seek to influence him. So that's a totally legitimate thing, give counsel, so forth. And if he says at the end of the day, I think this is the way our family, I'm leading to go, I think that getting in step with that and seeing how it goes would be honoring to God, okay? But that doesn't mean that you just roll over and does what he says. Like, give counsel, give wisdom, seek to make the best of it. Do what, Abigail is a really good example here of how you submissively, right, run counter to your husband. Because he's, the reason that she actually disobeys him, so Nabal's like insulting David, the king, who's got an army around the corner. Okay, and he's like, who's David? I don't care who that guy is, right, whatever. And she's like, David is going to hear that, and he might come and like wipe us all out, which ironically is what David is going to do. Like in his rage, he's like, he said what? We've been protecting his flocks. We've been providing shelter for him, and he's just going to like blow us off when we're hungry? No, 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 no. Boys, get on your swords. We gotta go. And Abigail hears that, like that's what's about to happen, and she said she takes initiative. And she says, in the absence of my husband, I'm going to protect this household by going and not fighting David, but going and bowing before David and saying, we brought you these gifts. And so it's still distinctly feminine, not masculine, but it's counter to what her husband did, and God honored it, blessed it, and would call her an excellent wife. So there's ways, even when your husband is being a manifest fool, to honor God, honor him, do good to him, and not necessarily do what he thinks. Does that make sense? So it's there's a whole bucket here of what I'm going to call the prudence bucket. I'll talk more about that tomorrow. There's a big bucket of prudence bucket. And maybe the other big piece to bring in here is you're never an island. So yes, you're a household, but there you're interfacing with a bunch of other households in the household of God. And so one of the things that ought to be happening is if your husband's being an idiot or unbelieving or manifestly disobedient, that's why you have other men in the church to call him to account, right? To exhort to and to press on him in areas of disobedience. This is what I do as a pastor all the time when I am dealing with marriage conflict is I want to come in and I want to exhort the people involved, if it's a husband, if it's a wife, to obey what God says. But your obedience to your husband maybe is to say this, is never absolute. It's always to God first, and then God is the one who says, wives, submit to your husbands in everything. Question? Yeah, uh-oh. Bring it.
If God had a perfect plan, would Adam and Eve sinning be part of that perfect plan?
Yes, that's a great question. So we're going to... Man, are we going to do this? We're going to do it. All right. Because that's a great question. It's a great question, right? Y'all just mad that he asked it. You were thinking it. Every one of you was thinking it, and he just had the courage to do it. So I'm going to distinguish between God's sort of like big picture ultimate plan and then what I'm going to call his moral plan. Okay? Moral plan is the moral design that he has for the way things ought to work. In that sense, the sin was absolutely contrary to it. Okay? Don't do it, Adam. If you day you eat of it, you'll die. Okay? Big picture plan, the story he's telling, absolutely a part of the plan. And if you go, how does that work? Well, you probably like stories. You ever read Narnia? Yeah? Okay, so if we got Narnia, we can work, right? So at one level, does Lewis like the White Witch? Do you think that Lewis is like, yay, always winter, never Christmas, Minnesota? Like, sorry. That's where I'm from. Does Lewis think that's a really good thing, that what she does and, you know, turning animals to stone, does Lewis like it? And the answer is no. But did he write it into his story? Yes. So it was a part of the story, but it was an ugly part of the story. And why did Lewis put the ugly part of the story in? Well, because he needed somebody for Aslan to kill and to conquer, right? And so why did God allow the fall? Why did God allow his moral will to be violated? Why did he do that? Because he's got a better story to tell. And the better story involves a cross and a resurrection and a church. And so God wants that story. And so he allows the ugly thing, the sin, into his good story in order to make the better thing possible. Really good question.
Joe, why is it that when Christians reject thick complementarianism, what you're... teaching here, and they embrace a thin complementarian viewpoint. Why is it that thin complementarianism becomes like a halfway house for full-on egalitarianism, and then often that egalitarianism becomes a waiting room for like LGBT, affirmation, and you see this, right? You see this with Amy Bird and Kristen Dumas and others, but I just wondered if you could comment on that slippery slope that seems to be...
Yeah, so that's part of what and doing the framework the way I'm doing it, I think that the indicatives are the first thing. Like, you won't keep the imperatives without... So you won't have... Maybe use a garden metaphor again, since those are fun. Without rich indicative soil, you will not get good imperative fruit. Okay? So... I'll use one. This is on the fly, so we'll see how far over my skis I get. But when Jesus tells the parable of the soils, right, there's the soil that has no root, right? The seed sown in the rocky ground has no root, so when tribulation comes, it withers and dies, okay? And he says that's like persecution and trial, burn up the thing. Now, so use that same kind of analogy. The indicatives of Scripture... What I've talked about, the husband is the head, the stuff in Genesis, all of that sort of stuff. That's like the fourth soil that is rich and fertile, and you plant seeds in that, and you're going to get a bunch of glorious obedience, and it's going to be awesome, okay? Thin complementarianism is like the thin soil. It's like the rocky ground, and you can put the good seed of the word there, only pastor, you know, only men, qualified men can be pastors, but there's no root, there's no richness to the soil, and so all it takes is a little heat and people will find a workaround. Okay? Because all you're left with is a real, you got like, and this is what they do. Here's five texts. Well, we'll explain that one away this way. Oh, it's just a context thing. Ephesus must have been really dealing with some women issues, and so Paul's talking about a particular situation, not a universal thing. In 1 Corinthians 11, like, angels, really? Who knows what head coverings are all about? So that one's off the table. And Ephesians 5, it's mutual submission. Don't you see that? Submit to each. And so it's every text all of a sudden has an excuse, and now you're to the next step. So the first step is hollow out the indicatives, and the second step is find your workaround for all the rest of the remaining imperatives, which is why you will notice that they tend to write two books. And the first book is the hollowing out of the indicatives, and the second book is the going the whole way. And I can you can actually track this. Like, the first book is, hey, we're complementarians, but a different kind than the bad ones. And the second book is, we're neither complementarians or egalitarians. And then the third book is, actually, we're just egalitarians. And the funny thing is we're standing back over here going, yeah, we knew from the first book. Like, I know, as soon as you got on that train, I knew where it was going. Right? That was obvious to the rest of us. We knew where that train leads. And yet you got really mad when we said, hey, you know that train goes to, you know, Kentucky. And hey, okay. All right, we'll pick a different one. You know that train goes to Virginia. Okay. All right. Where are we? We're in Tennessee. You know that train goes to Mississippi. Is that okay? I don't know what they're like. Who is it? They're all bad. That's right. All those places that we hate. We knew that's where that train was going, and that sooner or later you'd get there, and you're sitting there riding the train yelling at us like, no, it's not going there. And it's like, but your first book told us your destination. And because this isn't obvious, and so you just got to learn to read trajectories. He who says A must say B. That's why you will eventually get, it's not always, I will say this, and this is important. In engaging with people who are starting down that path, you have to distinguish between people who are leading the way and people who are stumbling and following along the way. There's the apostles who are like, hey, come with me, y'all. And then there are the people who are like, well, that sounds reasonable, and I had a bad experience at a complementarian church, and my husband was abusive, and all of that sounds attractive, and you better treat those people differently, okay? Because one of them there's something under that that really is driving the show, and what you want to do is address that, the real motive, the pain and the woundedness and whatever else. You want to be able to speak to that by strong godly leadership, and the other one you want to fight like it's a wolf. So we got wounded sheep and you got a wolf, and so treat them appropriately. And even though you can see the trajectory, you can warn others about the trajectory, but you shouldn't treat them like they've already arrived until they've arrived. Because there's always a possibility of them jumping off the train and coming back, right? And so even though I can see the trajectory, until they get there and start waving the rainbow flag, I'm not going to act like they're waving the rainbow flag. But I'll tell other people, that train goes to Rainbow Flagland. Okay, that's where that train goes. Don't get on that train. So I'll tell my people, don't get on that train, because it goes to the rainbow flag. That person, well, but that person doesn't. And it's like, that's because the train hasn't arrived yet. But that's just a timing thing. And oftentimes, the other thing, maybe last comment here, the train often is a generational train. So it's so we live in an accelerated era. Technology does this. And so it's like book one in 2015, book two in 2018, book three in 2021. It's one person going that route. Frequently, though, it's like some people can kind of pause at 2015, thin complementarian, for a long time, and it's the next generation that takes the next step. And then it's the next generation that takes the next step. And so part of wise leadership and discernment there is just making sure the particulars matter and not lumping everybody together. Go ahead. Uh-oh.
Anybody else?
That guy's got one. Little guy back there's got one in a minute.
The last little guy had a good question, so I'm going
to... Yeah, I know. I want to see. Oh, he's getting whispers, too. This is going to be good.
If my voice doesn't sound good in the microphone.
It's okay.
If God picks what happens, why does he let people sin?
If God picks what happens, why does he let people sin? Was that the question? Yeah. So if God chooses what happens, it's a similar reason what I said before about the kind of story God wants to tell. And God is a storyteller, and God is wise, and he has a story to tell. And so he's going to tell the story he's going to tell. Our responsibility is to be faithful characters, okay? And so it one way or another, in God's story, everybody's going to glorify him in the end. And so you're all going to, everybody's going to glorify God. But it matters whether you glorify him like Aslan or the White Witch. It matters whether you glorify him like John or like Judas. So we want to seek to live the way that God wants us to live and glorify him that way. But everybody's going to glorify him in the end one way or the other. And so it's the story he's telling that is why he allows and ordains that, that bad things happen. You got your question up here?
You're trying to understand and embrace these indicatives.
Yes.
So that we can better obey the imperatives.
Yes.
And we're having our eyes open to kind of how these gender and sexuality issues
yep.
need that rich soil.
Yeah.
What are other issues that you see in our culture or in our church today where the imperatives are being hollowed out? Or the indicatives are being hollowed out.
I think on just anthropology in general, like I mentioned, at the beginning, there's a notion of you can be whatever you want, like that human nature is totally plastic. It's Play-Doh. And it's just, can mold it in this way or mold it in that way, and it's I can make myself my own image or whatever. And so I think, like, humanity as a whole is sort of up for grabs. And I think that's downstream from the way that we relate to everything out there. So we think reality itself is moldable. I think our technology is part of the thing that tricks us into thinking that everything is moldable, because technology allows us to have so much dominion over stuff. Like, the things that I can do with technology are just, like, insane. Like, if you presented them to anybody before 1950, they would say that's magic. They would call it magic, which it is. And so our technology allows a kind of mastery over nature. This is Lewis, right? So mastery over nature that tricks us into thinking that we are the masters of the universe. And then we try to turn that scalpel back on ourselves and reshape ourselves into whatever we want to be. So it's anthropology as a whole that does that. But then by extension, it's wise use of technology would be kind of another place of, like, what is the world for? And how do we cut with the grain of reality in general? And how do we live in the world God made in a way that's in harmony with it as opposed to at war with it? And so those would be some other places of, like, kind of would require similar kinds of deep reflection of not just how do I live in harmony with God and with myself, but with the world around me. That would be one. Those are the last one that occurs to me. There's probably others.
Thank you very much.
Can I maybe give one more piece, since some of you guys won't be here tomorrow, let me give one more piece of counsel.
Okay.
Here's one of the ways, if you're trying to figure out, this is just a little tip on discernment, checking nature, like if you're skeptical about this, check your reluctances, okay? One of the most, Christian maturity, which we talk a lot about at Bethlehem, is one of the main aims of our education. One of the things is a certain kind of self-awareness, which includes paying attention to your hesitations, your reluctances, and your reactions, okay? So case in point, earlier tonight, so I'm putting this on the table because I want you to be aware of it. Earlier tonight when I was talking about the differences between men and women, and men are more this way and women are more that way, I don't know about this crowd, may be different just because you've got good teaching. Anybody feel nervous whenever I'm talking about men? So men are really aggressive, or men can be aggressive. Women can be manipulative, okay? Is anybody, the first one, if I say, hey, men can be aggressive, overly aggressive, harmful, does anybody feel any kind of like hesitation about me saying that? Like, whoa, whoa, watch out what you're saying there, man. I doubt it. If I say, hey, women can be manipulative, does anybody feel anything up in the throat? It's a good test, right? And the younger you are, the more you might feel it because you live in a different kind of culture. Older folks may go, I've seen plenty of manipulative ladies, thank you very much. And what's interesting is actually, I did this in one of my classes the other day. This is a test that I ran on my students when I was teaching on this. And it was, we were having this exact conversation. I had said the men can be aggressive thing. One of the other students piped up and said, hey, you know, in all this conversation about mixed audiences, you know, women can kind of be manipulative in that and know that men will kind of rush to their aid. If somebody, if they make an argument, and if a woman makes an argument and a guy comes at her, then other men will come to her defense, white knight, you know, save the day. And this guy, we were talking about that dynamic. And this guy said, yeah, and women sometimes know that and can be manipulative and kind of like do that and then jump back and wait for the white knights to come. And so he said, women can be manipulative. And I said, time out. How many of you just felt a little something in your throat whenever he said that? And it was interesting. What do you think the results? So I walk around, you know, go around the room. Who do you think raised their hand? The guys. The girls were like, you better believe it. Like, they'd seen that sort of thing. They knew what the other, they've seen the other women do that. So the women weren't offended at all. They were like, because it was like, yeah, women do that. Women can do that. Not all women do that. Not every woman does that. But women can do that. That's a thing for women. And the guys were like, oh, no, are the women going to be offended that he just said that? And so there's an angst in the room because of the men, right? Now, so there's a reaction. So here's what I said to do. You guys need to learn to interrogate that reaction. Like, ask it some questions. Because some of it might actually be noble. Because men and women are different, right? And so sometimes your reluctances are because you're recognizing God-given, God-designed good differences between men and women. Other times, it's just you've been catechized by the world and shaped and molded and formed by the culture we live in. And so that reluctance is the world's shaping getting in the way of true things. And you need to learn to recognize when that happens. So all of that is just an exhortation. If you're trying to figure out how do we navigate some of this stuff, learn to pay attention to your reluctances, your hesitations, and your reactions. All right, that's what I had to say at the end. There we go.
Well, we've been fed tonight. Thank you, Brother Joe.
Yeah.
He'll be back tomorrow. You pastors, you got to go pastor your own churches tomorrow. So it'll be online for tomorrow. But the rest of you, please come back. As you're walking out tonight on the table out there by the restroom, there's three articles that I put there today that track with what Joe was talking about tonight. One is by Joe Rigney called With One Voice, and it's giving a lot of the foundations for some of the things he said tonight. Another one's by a guy named G. Shane Morris called Rules Without Reasons. That's a very good article. And the third one was by Stephen Wedgeworth, and it was about head coverings in 1 Corinthians 11. So he's trying to deal with some of the things that Joe said he didn't understand tonight. Wedge tries to deal with those. So take some of those when you're leaving if you're interested. And please come back tomorrow. Pastor Carroll, would you dismiss us in prayer?